Addiction never affects just the addict. It affects all of us. Recovering from addiction and alcoholism is also a life-changing battle for families dealing with a loved one's addiction. Numerous programs support addicts as they reclaim their lives, while their families face their own challenges without the same guidance. You're listening to Voices in Courage with K.L. Wells, where we transform the lives of the families and loved ones of addicts and alcoholics from surviving to thriving in the midst of chaos. Tune in as we highlight vulnerable stories of families who have addicted relatives and friends and learn how they have dealt with the challenges of isolation, desperation, and shame. If you are seeking ways to live your best life, then we welcome you into this safe space. Be a part of change today with your host, K.L. Wells.
I'm thrilled to have you both in the same room.
Thank you. We are too.
Yeah. So just for my information, is this the first time the two of you have sat together to have this kind of conversation?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Great. Well, I want to just say thank you for doing this and having the courage and honoring me with your trust to do this. I totally believe, based on, you know, having spent time with both of you individually, that your story is very powerful and will, I believe, inspire many other couples that generally probably would not make it through. Yeah. So it holds a beacon of possibilities, your story does. So I appreciate this time. So I would like to kind of start with, you know, where in your journey as a couple was that transformational moment, almost that kind of made it before and after, that transformational moment that led to the reimagining and the coming together of your marriage anew?
I know what it was for me. I don't know what it was for you.
Well, ladies first. Go ahead.
First, yeah. I told Tucker that we had some challenges actually the last 5 weeks since I spoke with you. I think I spoke with you about a month ago. We've had some health challenges for Tucker. Well, you're aware of it, but I think it's important that we bring it up. Because what I said to him today was, I said, you know, I actually sent this video to my mother, and I also sent it to another family member husband is going through the exact same thing. And it really helped her. And I'm so grateful that we did it, because I know how alone and scared she is right now. And with that being said, I said to Tucker, I'm not going to sit here today and pretend like everything is champagne and bubbles, because based upon the last 5 weeks that we had, it's our responsibility to be authentic with people and say what actually happened, so we don't look like, oh, we've got this, you know, we're super together and isn't life grand? I said, there's so much good that I want to talk about. At the same time, it's extraordinarily important for us to be authentic.
Absolutely.
And honest and yes. Real, because we're helping nobody. Then what are we doing this for?
Right.
So for me, to answer your first question, and again, I'm actually a little nervous to talk about this with him today, because, you know, when we first started therapy, it would always end in arguments at the end, because, you know, it was so hurtful for both of us. So as we're starting something new, a new venture, I'm afraid, you know, I'm nervous that it could end in a similar outcome, not necessarily as intense, but, you know, we're both going to be talking. So when I say my way, I hope it doesn't hurt his feelings or affect him too much. But I would say it was this past fall when our therapist basically said to both of us, kind of, shit or get off the pot. And that was basically them saying, you know, we've been going around in this tornado with a marriage therapist for 2 years. And I had been dedicated myself to my own personal therapist one-on-one. But it wasn't until I said to Tucker, because we weren't going anywhere, and I was afraid it was actually that we weren't going to make it, that you need to genuinely commit to going to your one-on-one personal therapist, but also you need to get on medication. And this medication for him has made everything for us. It's just as important for me, for him, with sobriety as it is to be in this medication. It's just like an asthmatic being without an inhaler.
Yes.
And it's not necessarily the asthma is going to be here forever. It's just, we're in a pandemic right now. Everybody's stressed out. And, you know, you don't have a lot of outlets. And I can tell that you're suffering. But at the same time, this marriage is not going to make it if something drastic doesn't happen. And the moment he got on the medication, it didn't happen immediately. But you could see him slowly coming back and more and more. And so when it was somebody who I almost didn't recognize between work and at home, two very different people, he finally came together as one whole wonderful person.
Wow.
He was positive in the office, positive outside the office, genuine in the office, genuine outside the office. I saw the flirtatious, boyfriend start to come back. I saw the happiness. I saw the respect that I needed as a spouse. So that the medication was just as much of, it was an inhaler needed. It was just as much needed as a sobriety for me in order to continue with this. And when that happened, game changer.
Yeah.
Right. And is the medication like anxiety medication or?
Yeah. So this, to me, I think Jen brings up a good point. You know, we've talked about alcohol or the substance or the coping mechanism isn't the problem. It's the underlying root issue that's really the big deal. Absolutely. And I had gone for years and years with untreated anxiety. I mean, years, to the point where I can actually, now that I realize, I can go back and pinpoint certain parts of my childhood where my anxiety was super high. But, you know, back then, you know, the 70s, 80s, it was like, oh, just, you're just nervous, you know, chill out. You know, it's just, they didn't have the science that they do today or the neurochemistry to understand all of that. So, and Jen's right. You know, when I did my brain, I did brain mapping when I was in treatment, and there were parts of my brain that were overactive and parts that were underactive. And that's where the chemistry starts to put, you know, play a big role. I don't like medication. I don't like pills. I was never a pill guy. So the concept of medication, it wasn't admitting defeat, but it was also something that just felt still like something else had to control the situation. And I didn't want someone else to control it. But she's right. When that medication kicked in, which is basically a stabilizer for anxiety, it made a huge difference. If I were to answer that question, I think it actually is around the same time that I started on the medication. But our therapist had one word that seems, I keep coming back to, that I think has transformed the dialogue and the perspective for both of us. And the word is validation. Because I think before there was this inherent nature in both of us to be right, or to not win the conversation, but to make sure we're both Aries, we're both pig-headed, we're both stubborn, we're both strong-willed.
There's four of us under the same roof. Our kids are Aries too. Can you imagine? Like, no. Super Bowl betting, forget it.
But I think that concept of validation allowed for the concept of winning to be removed from the equation. So it didn't matter. It was, you feel this, I feel this.
Yes.
We're both going to agree that we both have these feelings, and neither of them are wrong because they're our own personal feelings, but listen and validate the other, listen and validate the other, and then come together and come up with a solution that then becomes a win-win versus you trying to overdo the other person. And it's changed even the way in which, you know, if there was an argument, if there's a disagreement, or we come to a head on something, the first thing we both say now is, I hear you. I'm validating what you're saying. However, I feel like this, you feel like this. Can we come together? And one word, I mean, that was a huge, huge breakthrough for us.
Right.
But you can't validate the other person's feelings until you're in full acceptance of responsibility of your side of the street, you know?
Yes.
And I think for both of us, whether you were the person at fault or not, understanding that you're responsible for your own actions and you're taking accountability for that is very big. And whereas before it was very easy for me to manipulate and push or deflect, now it's just a matter of, yeah, I see my part in this whole thing. I hear it. I validate what you're feeling, but I'm going to accept responsibility for my actions, learn from it, and then move on. And I think that was a huge breakthrough for both of us.
Yeah. I mean, I think in any relationship, when you're open enough to be able to hear the other person separate and apart from yourself, to really hear them because you love them and you want to understand their perspective and their where they stand and so on and so forth, that opens up so many things for possibilities. So I totally appreciate the validation piece of this. And then coupled with being able to get your anxiety, you know, tapped down, and at the same time, hopefully you're in the process of developing skills that deal with the anxiety. And I think, you know, just the whole brain science thing is completely fascinating to me, but that's another whole topic. So the big shift really took place just last fall.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Because we had a pendulum of events just sweep us, like just take us out. We had, if you can believe this, I mean, nobody wants to hear this. We had bed bugs. Like after the pandemic, like all of a sudden we had bed bugs, and Tucker didn't have like tiny welts. Tucker had like a bite, then a ring, then another ring around. I mean, it was like welts. And we couldn't figure it out because at that time they didn't want people coming in and out of appointments. Everything was telehealth. So it took about a month to figure out what was going on. But then I got it and we were just both broken out all over the place. then we have to go to another house, to his parents' house, to let them tent our home. And when we get there, it's 100. It was, I don't know if you remember this. It was during the time of all the wildfires. It was 120 degrees in the desert. There was a wildfire not 30 miles from us. And the sky was this ominous, like, what's the right word? You know what I'm talking about?
Apocalypse.
The yes. sun was like bright orange and there was clouds. You couldn't see more than like 50 feet in front of you. We got there, the air conditioning was broken. So it was like 130 degrees in the house and he handles that super well when he's hot. And then the washing machine broke. And water just started going everywhere. This is his parents' house, and his parents had this beautiful home. And there's this 2 inches of water. He forgot to turn the washing machine off, and the washing, and I'm like, somebody's going to get electrocuted. So in a matter of like a week, we had bed bugs, we had the apocalypse, and then we had a flood. And so he was not able to handle it at all. And I mean, at all. And so that is when I said to his doctor, it's medication or it's medication.
There's only so much emotional regulation therapy that you can muster. But again, it really goes back to the chemical imbalance.
Yes.
And, mm-hmm. Yes.
And yep. I think the world, I mean, as much as you hear about this over-medicated society, there's something to be said about Western medicine when it comes to finding chemical balance. Because I think, you know, a lot of people that suffer from mental health issues, it's a chemical imbalance. And for me, I think that's what kind of, and stress is additive to that. So you add stress and other stressors, it's a recipe for, you know, basically an emotional explosion.
And that's mm-hmm. what happened. And that's what happened. It was just one after another. And I also want to say that I know that there's going to be a lot of different people watching this. The medication was what Tucker needed. But again, I want to say this as we talk. Everybody's different because I know a lot of people choose holistic ways or they're very much against medication. And I completely understand that. It was for him. It was kind of like when he got out of the rehab, when they said his brain is mush. It has to regrow. It has to redevelop. And so I think that was just a big piece of things that's what was right for him. That is not necessarily what's right for other people, but we certainly realized through the series of events that something had to happen.
Right. Well, and I completely appreciate you saying that because, you know, this isn't about telling people how they should do it.
Exactly.
This is about opening up the window into your story.
Yes.
And they can pick the things that they hear that resonate with them and let the rest go.
Right. Yeah. And that's why, because when you asked what was a turning point, I'm always very hesitant to say that out loud. Because especially after going through a pandemic and then the presidency of all that happened this year, everybody has their own opinion and everybody has their own background and everybody has their own set of beliefs. And I respect that about everybody, but I hope that people will understand that this is just what happened with us.
Yeah.
Yes. This is just your story.
Yes.
Yeah. I think the common thread here for everybody is that stressors create stress.
Yes.
And how we handle it, there's a multitude of ways to handle it. And this is what worked for both of you.
Yes.
Yeah. Two things I want to bring up. And actually on that too, I used to do some work inside prisons and was doing some programming inside prison. And I'll never forget the first day I walked onto a yard and I met Shaky. His name was Shaky. He came up to me and because he had this little bit of a shake and he said, you know, hi, my name is Shaky. And I asked him, I said, specifically, what's your biggest life lesson that you've learned since being here? He goes, when you enter the prison system, they strip you of everything. And they fill you with nothing. And that was one of the most profound things I've ever heard. And when you think about it from the perspective of someone who's struggling with substance abuse, when you strip them of the coping mechanism,
yes,
and you fill that person with nothing, it's a recipe for disaster. So there's this tendency when, okay, I'll just stop drinking, or I'll stop doing this, or I'll stop gambling, or, you know, whatever it is, that is just automatically going to self-regulate your body when in fact it actually puts it into shock. So part of that is being able to fill it with things that make sense for that particular person. And the reason I bring that up too is I think another turning point for us is it's so easy to put all of the emphasis and all of the therapy and healing on the person that struggled with the addiction or the problem and completely ignore the loved ones.
Right.
You know, let them fend for themselves because they're not the problems of the problem. Well, at the end of the day, one of the things I think was great for Jen was to say, hey, it's my turn. I want some support. So can we focus on me too? And I think allowing her to have all the resources and the tools that she needed for herself was a huge thing because a lot of people forget about that. And I mean that in a very positive way, because I think for Jen, it was like, I need my healing. You've got your stuff. Let me focus on me too. And I think that was a big eye opener for me because I always felt like it fell on me to have to do certain things or whatever it was. And the loved ones are kind of like, well, they get the byproduct or the benefit of the other person going through the therapy. But what I didn't know is how much damage I had done for the loved ones, right? So for her to be able to have access to those resources and focus on herself for once, she deserved it. You deserve all of that.
Yeah.
And for having to put up with so much, it was great that, you know, you each have your own path of healing.
Yes.
Then you can't heal together if you don't heal the parts of yourself that were hurting.
Yes. Well, do you think that your dealing with this disease was kind of the call to everybody healing in your family?
To a certain degree. I've told you this before that, you know, if Tucker were to give up a TED talk, you know, what would it be? And I've said this concept of how alcoholism restored family values. It has allowed us to heal as a family, but also I think not necessarily heal, but also educate and help raise our kids in ways that they're going to be emotionally intelligent. They're going to be prepared for real life. And they've been through some tough times so that when they do encounter the tough times when they're on their own and out in the real world, they're prepared for it. So there are parts when I think healing, there's the healing components, but I think there's also the emotional intelligence and education behind some of the stuff that we're able to provide our kids that's going to make them way more resilient than others. So that's a component that I always, you know, because I worried about it. You know, it's like, you know, what have I done to the kids and that sort of thing. But the truth of it is they've seen the rawness of it. They've seen the hurt. They've seen the pain, but they've also seen the incredible beauty that comes out of two people really focusing on a relationship. Because it's not easy. So it's not all about the unicorns and rainbows. They get to see the storms that we have to weather. You know, there's that old saying that, you know, it wasn't that my parents were wrong. My parents are still growing up, you know, and we are. We're still growing up and doing our, you know, our thing too. So,
yeah. What do you think, Jen?
I think that, you know, it's interesting that he mentions that because we actually had two very different ways of growing up. My parents were one extreme, his parents were another. And so, and what I mean by that is, Tucker's parents were very conscientious to shield them from hurt. So if his father was having any kind of thing that any normal person would have at work, anything, any stressor, they didn't really tell the Tucker and his sister. And so they, when it came time for Tucker to become an adult, when he did get hit with things, he didn't know how to handle them because he wasn't, for lack of a better word, given the exposure or the tools.
Emotional
intelligence to handle it. So for me, my parents would tell me more than I necessarily needed to know. Like when my father lost his job, we're not eating steak anymore. We're going to be eating hot dogs at every meal. And we got to get this gas. And this is the only amount of gas that we can have. And we got to take away the car insurance. I mean, stuff that like a 10-year-old was like, what are you saying? I'm 10. Like, what are you talking about? And I think I mentioned this in our last interview that, and again, my mother's going to laugh at me because she says, it's so funny to see what you really thought of what it was like growing up with us versus what actually happened. I go, okay. Let's, you know, have that be another conversation. But my parents were very open. And again, like I say, too much. And they were very hard work. And there wasn't time for a lot of play. It was a lot of raking leaves and shoveling snow and all that and mowing lawns and chores. And so when it came time to being, when Tucker and I would hit a problem, like a financial problem or whatever, I didn't really react as heavily as he did. I was able to handle it more because I know what it's like to, I don't want to say the word poor, but I know what it's like to not have enough money to do X, Y, Z. So when he says, you know, our kids are growing from this, oftentimes one of the things we disagree about is we don't need to tell the kids. I go, no, we're going to tell the kids because they need to know when life hands them a pile of crap, how do you respond? And I said, we don't need to scare the crap out of them and make it seem like life is over. But I said, you know, we're not going to be totally quiet about it, but we don't need to go to the extremes of my father, like letting us know that the world was ending. We have to expose them to it. So when he's saying, you know, our kids are going to be more prepared, I would say that is something now we're starting to unite a little bit more on, because before I was the one who's always like, we got to tell them the truth, because when they're by themselves and they have to make decisions and they have to cope with something, I want them prepared. I want them to know what that is like versus being in a bubble.
Absolutely. Yeah. And one of the things that both of you referenced in the interviews that I did with you was the ability to ask for help.
I never had a problem with that.
I'm smiling because I literally was thinking about that today. Seriously, because as you know, I had to reschedule this time 4 times today because of the unexpected things that popped up today and all the driving that I did. And I recognized that what I was doing today was exactly the treadmill that I had been on for years, where I was taking who needs to be where, what needs to be done when, and forgetting to not have time to go to the bathroom. I mean, what? Not have time to eat. I didn't have my lunch until 3 p.m. today. That's how I used to operate every single day. And I wouldn't come home till 8 or 9, and then I would have dinner late. And that's, again, how you get the weight on and all that kind of stuff. But I finally said to Tucker today, I said, I need help. And I had a firm boundary, because I don't think that really before this, I expressed myself firmly, not meanly, but firmly, to say, like, this is enough for me. Like, I can't handle anymore. Because we actually had the conversation the other day. On Sundays, he gets very tense. It's like he's ramping up for the week, and he hates Sundays. And quite frankly, I hate being around him on Sunday because he gets so anxious and stressed. And I said to him yesterday, I go, I can guarantee you that tomorrow you're going to sit in front of your computer and you're going to do great. Because I said, I love Monday and Tuesdays because they're very productive days for you. And I guarantee you something great's going to happen on Monday. But he had said the other day, he goes, I need you to carry more weight. I need you to maybe go back to work. And I about, let me tell
lost
you,
about it.
A year and a half ago, I would have like, but again, because of all the therapy, I said, okay, what did they say for me to do?
Validate.
And I was believing it. Like, I was like, I have no desire to validate you right now. But I said to him that I recognize that it's very stressful during a pandemic to be a one income household. But I said, right now, I just need you to please take care of yourself and take care of the job. And I'll take care of the children and the house and all the other stuff that comes with it. But for you to ask me right now to go back to a job, I did that twice before. I went right back to a job because he said, go back to a job. And then that's when the cancer scares happened. That's when my body started shutting down. So I know the difference now. Before, I would have said, okay, you want me to jump? Jump how high? Do you want me to go back to work? How much money do I need to do? And so when you say asking for help this weekend, I was very firm in saying, I recognize. And what did happen today? He got 2 new clients today. I said, I told you. But it's recognizing when to hold a boundary that's not an unkind boundary, but a genuine, I can't do any more for you or for the family boundary. And so today I asked for help. Yesterday I said, I was able to say, no, I cannot go back to work maybe 6 months from now. Happy to go back to work. But right now, as we're all adjusting back to school and all of these things right now, no, we need to get our really better grounding on our feet. And a year and a half ago, I wouldn't have asked for help and I wouldn't have held a boundary.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's really important for people who are listening to this to recognize that, you know, we each have our own journeys. Mm-hmm. We each have our own timing. And if we can love each other, each through our own journeys, then we can come together.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yep. 1000%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so say a little bit more in terms of the ability to ask for help.
Me or him?
Which one?
Okay. Go ahead.
Well, I think for me, you saw where not asking for help went. Clearly that. But I think this goes back to a lot of the work that I've done specifically in the recovery space around, you know, helping other men who can relate to this, but you know, we have lived historically in a society where asking for help is obviously a sign of weakness, or it may be admitting defeat. And I didn't see my father or my grandfather or the other males in my life. I didn't have a brother. I didn't see the other males asking for help ever. So we often mirror what we see. And because that wasn't part of my upbringing, I never really asked for it. I always tried to figure things out on my own. And it wasn't until I saw, you know, where that can take a person, but realizing that, you know, I had this new philosophy that, you know, asking for help isn't a sign of weakness. It just means I have things that are so great in my life, it requires other people to support me. And there's a difference when you shift that perspective from that way. Before it was, I don't have a lot going on, but I want to ask for help. So, you know, I'm just going to kind of isolate and drown myself in a hole. But now it's like, well, I've got so much passion and angst to want to do things on a much bigger scale, realizing that asking for help and creating healthy boundaries and asking for, you know, this is where we start to step into our zone of genius and surround yourself with really good people, it changes the trajectory of everything. Well, I didn't have that skill set or that vision, you know, before. So now when I raise my hand and I ask for the help, I don't even think twice, but I can still see where a lot of people around me, especially men around my age and in their mid 40s, that is just like, it's not about asking for directions because you're lost. I mean, it's literally about, if I ask, I'm going to be seen completely different. And my ego is going to be completely destroyed if somebody else sees that weakness. So that's been a really great journey for me to understand this concept of ego and how that plays into it. So now I don't think twice. But that took many years and many falls mm-hmm. to realize that the only way I can get back up is to ask for help. And it's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Jen?
I would again be speaking on the most recent experience, just because, as I mentioned to you, that the last 5 weeks have been really tough. They weren't sure if Tucker had a brain tumor because he lost hearing in his right ear. So he was, as any human would be, I mean, just in shock, not really doing much because he couldn't hear. And then he would have to fall asleep at night to noise in the television in the background because it was the ringing was so tough. And that was really hard for me because right after I'd spoken to you, this all started to unfold. And it was right in our marriage therapy that we literally were just starting to date again. Like we were planning on how Tucker was going to ask me out and we were going to start to, what do you call it? When
courtship.
That's it. Courtship.
Yay.
I had it all planned out, KL.
I was bringing all the moves back. I was so disappointed. We were supposed to go on a date and everything. And it just all, we were supposed to have a Valentine's Day dinner outside. And our daughter was going to be our little waitress and take our orders. And we haven't done anything since. So it's been a month now. And it was so much watching him look the way that he felt during a month of, do I have brain cancer? And so everything that we had built up to almost felt like it had just been diminished. It's not, we'll get it back. But finding out this morning that he doesn't have brain cancer is a tumor is a huge deal. But during that time, our therapist said, you have to ask for help. And I was thinking to myself, well, who the heck am I going to ask for help? And I'm not sick, like I can make a meal. But what I did do is I finally reached out to my mother and then my best friend. And I did tell them what was happening. I said, I'm just letting you know, because 5 years ago when he was struggling, I wouldn't have told anybody, would have carried the weight and the stress on my shoulders. And I said, I'm simply telling you because I want to walk the walk that I'm saying, which is telling people when you're struggling. And it's even if it's just saying it out loud, so somebody else knows. So if they try and call me and I'm not available to talk or I'm, you know, short or whatever it is, that they know what's going on. So my way of asking for help this time was simply a listening ear, because that's what I needed and I needed somebody to know. But I also asked Tucker for help. There was a period of time when he was just struggling so much with the fear of, do I have a brain tumor? It was just a lot of the same patterns came back. I have to clap for him that he remained sober during a very difficult time that anybody would have wanted to pick up a drink and he didn't. So massive kudos to him for that. At the same time, the emotional trauma that he was experiencing, many of the similar patterns of behavior when he was at the height of his disease came back, and that was crushing. So finally, one afternoon, I just couldn't handle it anymore. I just sat down. And he was just kind of having a, I don't know,
breakdown.
I just simply said quietly to him, I just said, you're a lot right now. You're a lot to manage and handle, you're a lot to handle. I said, you're a lot to handle right now. And that's all that I said. And again, 2 years ago, it would have come through anger. It would have been an outburst of a fight. It came after the validation of feelings that we're supposed to be doing in our therapy. But me saying, you're a lot right now, and I can't handle where you are right now. And saying it quietly.
I thought it was a compliment, but apparently it wasn't.
he didn't say anything after that. I think he got it.
I don't mean to interrupt, but what was interesting about
it. Because I thought it was great.
No, what was interesting about it was so much. 5 years ago, I couldn't recognize it.
No.
Right?
Right.
Like this time, being on a horrible, and we've talked about, you know, prednisone being the worst medication on the planet, but literally as if I was out of my body watching myself going through all of this, I got to actually experience myself in a way that I didn't know that's what Jen was experiencing years ago.
So wow.
It was actually really, I mean, not to make it positive out of it, but let's find the silver lining anyway. It was an interesting experience to be like, oh my gosh, I get it now. I get the dual persona and this and that, and trying to like having to put on an act because I'm not feeling good, and the wearing these masks and worried about people pleasing, all that stuff just came rushing back, which was very anxiety ridden. I mean, to the point where I couldn't sit in my skin. I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm having all of the feelings I had before. The only difference is I'm not numbing them out with something, you know, to cope with.
Right.
Now I'm actually having to feel the feels.
Yes.
So it was actually a very good, I can look back on it now and know the trajectory of where things are going. But at the time, it was interesting for me to be able to step back and say, now I see what Jen saw.
Right.
Now I understand what she went through. Mm-hmm. And to be able to almost like literally say, I'm going to apologize right now for what I'm about to say because I have no control over what I'm about to say, but I know I'm going to say it. I mean, it was literally just like that. And then it would come out and be like, I can't control it. It was that I had that much of an effect on me. And the moment that I got rid of the medication and was able to start feeling again and realizing it's like, okay, I can regulate those emotions and I feel like the chemistry's back.
The medication that you're referring to is a steroid to get rid of the, let's clarify that.
Right, the prednisone.
High dosage, very heavy steroid that just.
And he truly said, basically one time he goes, I'm about to be an but I'm going to say it anyway. And I'm like, wow. and I knew like.
That's self-awareness.
But as I'm saying, I was like, so you're going to do it anyway? Okay. But that was the pendulum of where he swung back. And so with asking for help, I knew that I couldn't get help from him, but I said, you're a lot to manage right now. That was me basically asking for help in the sense of just please stop. Please stop bombarding me with the behaviors that destroyed us, you know, years ago. Please, let's not. I'll be patient as you're on the steroid to get rid of this ringing in your ear, but we're not going back to this. This isn't going to be status quo.
Yeah. Well, embedded in this story is both of you doing this a really different way. I mean, your ability, Jen, to very calmly say you're a lot to handle right now. And for you, Tucker, to have the experience of almost out of body watching yourself and then that clarity of seeing, oh my God, that's who I was. I mean, the way that I think about it is that's an extraordinary gift for you to have that perspective that you didn't have previously. And so
if I had to deal with me, I would have drank too.
Okay, maybe come forward.
And I bring that up too, because, you know, this interview is meant to not just be a reflection on us, but also, you know, what we can give to others. Finding humor in the past,
yes.
Finding humor in the pain, if you can't go back and laugh at ourselves for the triumphs that we've accomplished and recognize how ridiculous some of the behaviors were and some of the stuff that we've overcome, that also brings back a lot of the, you know, oh, there they are, you know, those kinds of little things that we can go back and find humor in.
And speaking of humor, I'm going to just let y'all in on a little secret in just a moment. But I think part of it was also letting go of some ego, letting go of the ego and telling our part of the our journey, you have to let people see their real you. And so the other day, my mom goes, your hair looks great. I go, really? Thank you. It's because I just picked up on what all these women do online. The hair scrunchie. And I'm just being real here, ladies.
Yeah.
I lost so much hair. When I was going through the height of when he was really sick, my hair would come out in clumps. And I had to get extensions because my hair was so thin, you could start to see my scalp, like to the point where you were almost like an elderly person at my age, like at what I would look like at 80, 85. That's how much hair I lost. And so with the pandemic, I stopped with the extensions, but you could see how much hair loss I had from all the stress. And so being real, it's a scrunchie, but you know, it's those things there that I would never have admitted 2 years ago. This is a hair scrunchie, or
yeah,
or pretending like I haven't gained all the weight that I have because I have. Being comfortable in your own skin and saying this is what it is, and not letting the ego get in the way of looks or being worried about what people are going to think of me. Life is way too short, and so when he talks about humor, I always think of this because while losing hair is not fun and scary, honestly, when it comes out in clumps, that's part of just a little bit here, a little bit there.
I'm aging gracefully, though.
He's a George Clooney look going on right now. And he's so much better than women, I think. He's like getting handsomer as he ages, and I'm just getting the wrinkles, like I said before, but oh well.
You got well-earned wrinkles, my friend.
Well, thank you.
That's right. Those are called wisdom lines.
Yeah, I have a lot. I must be really smart. Must be really wise.
Yeah.
That was part of my strategy.
Thank you. Oh, you're so sweet. Always thinking of others.
So what I want to shift to is just the whole notion of forgiveness, forgiving ourselves and forgiving each other.
That word was tough. It's not now, but it was a really tough word. And the concept of, you know, one of the first things that I was taught was you're not going to be able to gain the forgiveness of others if you can't forgive yourself first. I'm like, what are you talking about? How does that even work? And part of the self-forgiveness is recognizing and honoring the pain and the stuff that, you know, eventually at some point became some of the biggest lessons in my life. But that concept of forgiveness, I thought no one's ever going to be able to forgive. And one of the things that we struggled with a lot was words, because, you know, that concept of I'm sorry when you're in active whatever mode becomes, at one point, Jen said, those two words coming out of your mouth no longer mean anything. They're not even part of your vocabulary. And when you can finally say, it's not about saying the words, I'm sorry anymore. It's about showing I'm sorry through actions. So at that point, I stopped saying I'm sorry. And then I had to completely just literally walk away and come back with action. And I had to show, from my perspective, self-forgiveness was honoring the pain, honoring what was going on, and honoring the why, and honoring, you know, the commitment to becoming healthier. It was, like I said before, recognizing that I'm not a bad person, doing bad things. I'm a sick person trying to get healed. But I found that the most important way for me to show forgiveness was through action. And they often say that in terms of, you know, making amends or this living amends concepts of, it's not about walking up to the person and saying, I'm sorry for what I've done. It's, I'm sorry for what I've done. Now let me show you how important you are in my life by what I'm about to do through action. So that concept of forgiveness on my end had nothing to do with the words. It had nothing to do with creating a specific moment in time that says, I'm sorry. It was probably 1 to 2 years of full action of regaining trust and showing that through action, showing that through gestures, showing that I can rise from all of this. That's where forgiveness for me had to play a huge role.
Jen?
Well, I'm going to speak on the most recent, just because I think that's the most authentic for me now, rather than going backwards years back with the forgiveness. I think that what he's talking about in terms of when his actions, he would just say sorry over and over and over again. And then oftentimes he would put together family videos while I'd be at work, like till get there when the light was coming up, leave when the sun's going down. And I was exhausted. And while I'd be gone, sometimes he'd be putting together family movies of videos. And he did that several times. And he'd say, look what I put together for you. And he was doing that to try and gain my forgiveness and develop something back. But it did exactly the polar opposite for me. It made me so hurt and frustrated and angry, because what I needed was someone to help with like the dishes at home, or like a carpool or something like this. And so the forgiveness part for me was really difficult in the beginning, because he was giving me an apple and he wanted an orange, or vice versa. And so we were just kind of missing the mark with each other. And so now with therapy, when she said, you need to specifically say what it is that you need and be like short to the point and specific. And once I was able to figure that out, then it started to come back together. And truly, like having him empty a dishwasher was, I mean, oodles of gratefulness on my part. And because he was listening to what I needed, because I couldn't continue to do all that I was doing. Or like today, like when you ask about, when I talk about being current with forgiveness, I feel very guilty today that I couldn't keep up driving 10 different places in the matter of 5 hours and why can't I do that? I used to do that all the time. I was on a treadmill. Why can't you do that anymore, Jen? So I trouble forgiving myself today and then asking for help and saying, Tucker, I need you to do this last leg because I can't do it. And when he did that for me, he did a pickup. But that was so important to me. So when he did little actions like that, what he's talking about, more often, more often, more often, and then me validating and say, thank you so much. That is exactly what I needed. I really appreciate you. That's when the forgiveness started to naturally flow back and forth.
And what would you say for the people that are listening in terms of understanding how important it is to forgive themselves, much less their partner?
It's so important. And I think, like I said in the initial interview, I'm still working on that. I've said this before, I'm not going to pretend to be somewhere I'm not yet. And this is where I'm at. And I wish I wasn't. I wish I was a little bit more each day. But the forgiveness part for me is tough. And like I said, when he said, you need to go back to work, forgiving myself and saying, I'm not well enough yet to be able to handle a job and 2 children in a home during a pandemic, being forgiving myself and saying, you can't do all of that. Like I said, 2 years ago, I said, okay, how high am I supposed to jump? And so there's nothing to forgive because I was just doing everything for everybody else.
Right, right. Yeah. Tucker, what do you think for the people that are watching about the importance of forgiving themselves, much less the partner or spouse that they're with?
Well, if you can't forgive yourself, you're never going to heal. You're just not. You're asking for history to repeat itself. You fall into shame. You fall into guilt. You fall into self-pity, you fall back into ego, you fall back into being selfish, and then you're just back in. There's just, it's hard to hear. It seems almost like an oxymoron, but you know, one of the most selfless things to do is to forgive yourself, even though it sounds incredibly selfish, but it is the first step. And from there, it's all about actions speaking louder than words. It's about changing the vocabulary and changing your behaviors. And like she said, sometimes it's the simplest of things. But those simple gestures, you know, depending upon what your love language is or whatever that is, those can speak volumes. Now you recognize them. But that's also, again, putting up a lot of boundaries and putting up a lot of, I need this, you know, I need this. And it's not until we're able to be able to specifically say what I need, can you actually honor, you know, because a lot of the times we make these assumptions like we're doing good things for the other person. But if it's not what they need, it's actually a disservice. So listen to what they need and follow through.
And what about the moments where you ask for what you need and you're looking at your spouse and they don't have the capacity. Have you found yourself reaching outside of asking your spouse when their capacity is maxed?
That's a real hard one for me to answer. And the reason why I say that is because when he was sick, there wasn't any capacity to do much. And so it was a very lonely 5 years. And that question really, really hits home for me. And it's hurtful. Honestly, it makes me want to cry because there was no capacity for a long time at all. And that's hard. I mean, because then that stirs up a lot of anger and resentment. Like, how can you not empty a dishwasher? Like, it's super easy. A teen's can empty a dishwasher. Why can you not do that? Why can you not get dinner? That is when I had a lot of resentment built up. And so that piece is a really large piece. So I had to learn, again, through therapy, to just step away and let go and stop asking until I could realize that and see that he's getting better and healthier, that he could start to give a little bit more, that the capacity was getting a little bit bigger and then a little bit bigger. But know to be patient, to wait for that capacity to get to the point where he can do it. I think he wanted to, but he just really couldn't.
It's hard to be incapacitated that way
when little
things become...
Can you speak on that? Because it was really hard. It was awful.
And it wasn't for a lack of, I don't even know how to describe it. When you're in an active mode where your brain is just not supporting you anymore, the even mundane, the smallest of things feel like giant Mount Everest to climb. And I have no explanation for it other than there's the motivation is so not there. And it's even hard to talk about sometimes. You can't even think of for this, the littlest of things. And it's like, you know, we have a 16-year-old and a 13-year-old. And it's like, we can't get them to freaking do the dishes. It's the same concept. It's like your brain reverts back to oblivion. It just doesn't register. And that's part of having to really rebuild the neurochemistry that's inside the brain. And that's when you know that you're sick, is because it just nothing that's supposed to be simply a human whatever, it just changes everything. So
yeah. And they told me to lower my expectations and then lower them even more. Right. And then really basically just be at this. And then if you get a little bit of this and a little bit of capacity, be grateful. So I had to basically expect nothing.
Yeah. 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 And the weight, you know, because you don't know what you don't know. I mean, it really is a spiritual journey.
Right. And that's what was so scary when the reason why I bring up, when I told Tucker, we're going to tell them about the last 5 weeks, because the steroid that they placed him on for this thing, this ear problem, I told you in the early segment that I did grapes, gentle with self, relaxation, accomplished, pleasure, exercise, social. While he was sick, I wasn't getting to any grapes. And so one morning I finally sat outside and I was gentle with myself and took out Jesus Calling. I was going to have a cup of coffee. I invited him to come out with me. And I was in the corner of our porch because we have our dates on our porch. I was in the corner of our porch and he had just walked out the door and our puppy went 2 steps down from him. And I'm in this corner. So I'm like 10, 15 feet away from the puppy. The puppy could have reached out and grabbed the dog. He goes, the dog went down the stairs. Can you go get the dog?
But it brought me back to this.
And it brought me back. It was a trigger for both of us because I was right. Like, we're not going back here. My dog's right there.
So incapacitated.
I mean, what? But that's again saying like two people who are in our situation, there are going to be bumps in the road. Like we hit a bump. And it was a big bump for us. Like the bed bugs and the washing machine breaking were like, they were pretty good, tiny bumps. But this problem that we had was a significant bump. And the triggering that came back for me and for him, that was something that I want to say that happens. And he basically had the only way I could call it, in an emotional relapse.
Actually, that's a
great way to frame it.
That's a great term.
Wow. Wow.
Score. That was good.
Yeah. Yeah, that was really good. I've not heard that before. And that makes like so much sense.
Thanks. Yeah.
So much sense. Yeah. Wow.
I would say that's the biggest side effect that still lingers. It's the emotional relapse.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that's just being naturally human. But the other part is still being able to self-regulate and recognize when it's coming on and be able to nip it before it gets, you know, too big.
Right. Right. And at this point, I mean, having had the last 5 weeks, are you able to see like how far you've come? I mean, the last 5 weeks have been a test, a trial and an opportunity for you to see both of you and collectively as a couple, how far you've come.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how much I was looking forward to the courtship. I mean, it's easy to just not even care or not even want that. And to both be excited about that and have that taken away makes that desire for that to happen even more than before. But also, I think we look at the last decade and kind of the first 5 years when he was really sick, then the 5 years, and I still think that he was sick when he was sober because he was trying to come out of just basically wherever he had placed himself. And it was super hard for him, like little chapters. And this was a different chapter. But in that decade, there was pain, there was anger, there was resentment, there was isolation, there was all these different terrible things. Now that we've had the opportunity to heal separately, and again, I'm not there fully, but I think further along because he started earlier than I did, and understanding that we love each other unconditionally no matter what. And so while this was a temporary thing, it still brought out, frankly, the ugly that I never wanted to see again. And I saw it again. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. But knowing that we've been through something before, we can get through it again. But also, I think I was a little bit more assertive. There are more boundaries. And if he would do something negative, I would come like this and we would just create a bonfire. If he would come at me during that 5 weeks, I would know not to come back as like a bear, and because it doesn't help. So all the things, all the tools that we've been taught, we're able to navigate the last 5 weeks more effectively, efficiently, and more calmly and lovingly than if we didn't have those tools and took that time to heal. It would have been a totally different experience.
Yeah.
We're coming up against the edge of our time here. So I'm just curious for each one of you, what's the one thought, the one lesson, the one piece that you think is so important that people who are listening to this understand as the spouse or as the one who has the disease for them to take with them?
Not to simplify it, but I think this is the most powerful thing, regardless of the depth to which, because everyone experiences this family disease in a different way. It hits everybody differently, regardless of, and we're taught to never compare trauma, never to compare, you know, this is worse than the other. We all experience it in different ways and we all have our separate stories. At the end of the day, you can recover. It's, and I always say it's the one disease that has a cure if you do the work, but it takes a lot of discipline, but it's possible. It's not cancer. It's not life-threatening if you follow the medication, which is doing the work. It feels kind of strange to say that it takes both parties to do it. But at the end of the day, as Jen said, if you love the person unconditionally, then you commit to it. And it does take both parties. It takes the spouse, it takes the kids, whatever. The kids have committed to understanding all of this too. I mean, it's very easy for the kids to write somebody off. But recovery is always possible, no matter the depth. But it takes a lot of hard work. But the answer is there. There is a cure. And that's something that, you know, a lot of people can't say about certain diseases. There is a cure.
I would say for me, I feel like when Tucker talks, he's a lot more polished than I am because I feel like he's had a lot more time and counseling and support and attention. And so I feel like when I'm speaking, I feel like I'm just a blubber of verbal diarrhea, because I haven't had the time, resources, opportunities, quite frankly, to be placed number one. And you can only do that for yourself. And I'm trying to do that now more. But I feel like if I could just ask for, I don't know if forgiveness is the right word, but understanding from anybody who's listening and hearing me, that if what I say is not perfect, or if what I say doesn't resonate with you, or if it hurts you in any way, that would never ever be my intention. It's, you know, even just saying the word that Tucker had to go on a medication, I fear that I said that, like, oh gosh, I said that he went on a medication that helped him, because I know everybody's different and I know everybody has their own opinion. And so, you know, I'm a very sensitive person. I've had a lot happen to me. And so I would say the one thing is that is if someone who is the spouse or the parent or child coming from a place where they've experienced what they've experienced and are just beginning to tell their side of the story, if it doesn't come out as well as we hope it would be, speaking for myself, to please be patient with us as we begin our own journey of recovery and healing. Because I just feel like when he was in his journey of recovery and healing, it was so private and so confidential. And there's so many journals, and it was in the hospital, it was in a rehab facility. This is me coming out really like would have been one of my first sessions, and I'm coming out publicly. It's really, honestly, when I think about that and I sit back and I realize what I do, I was like, oh my gosh, what did I just do? Sometimes I'm afraid to say what I've said, but it's, so I guess just coming from a place of compassion, mm-hmm. If people could just come from a place of compassion for me, just to know that I know I'm not perfect and I know that what I'm saying isn't going to always resonate or be right, but please be compassionate because I'm trying to help other people who are where I was. That would be the other thing that I would say.
Well, what I would say is, knowing you like I know you now, is the courage that it takes to be raw and real is, your courage is tremendous.
Thank you.
Tremendous.
Thank you.
And you never have to say it. There's not a right way to say it. But I do think that, you know, just what you spoke to is why Voices in Courage was born.
Yeah.
Is because most of the industry focuses on the one who's suffering from the disease. Mm-hmm. It's the family that's left on the wayside to figure it out. Exactly. And so he's had a whole lot more work, whole lot more journaling, hospital, blah, 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 which is fantastic. And you were just trying to hold life together at the time that he was in on, you know, that part of his journey. And so I want you to recognize,
thank you,
how courageous you really are. And I personally, for me personally, what I love the most about you, Jen, is your courage, is your realness, is your being vulnerable and raw, because that's what people need. They need to know this isn't just he stopped drinking and he got some help and we're all fine now.
Oh, that's only so easy.
Thank you. That means a lot, because like I said to him, I'm going to tell the truth. If I don't do that, then what is this for?
Exactly.
And I had to trust in him enough that he's not going to get angry at me like was 10 years ago when we would start talking about this. So to have the security and safety knowing that I can say
your truth.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a tremendous gift. And that's all we can do is speak our own truth, whether it's Tucker's truth or your truth or my truth or whoever's. What's true in the moment right now? And to be able to give that voice, you have permission to give that voice.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. So I want to thank you both.
Thank you.
From the bottom of my heart for taking this time, for showing up, for being real and raw, and, you know, speaking for so many people that are going through this right now, individually and as a couple. This will be powerful for people to hear.
We hope so.
Yeah, that's why we're doing it.
I know.
Well, thank you, Kale.
Addiction never affects just the addict. It affects all of us. Recovering from addiction and alcoholism is also a life-changing battle for families dealing with a loved one's addiction. Numerous programs support addicts as they reclaim their lives, while their families face their own challenges without the same guidance. You're listening to Voices in Courage with K.L. Wells, where we transform the lives of the families and loved ones of addicts and alcoholics from surviving to thriving in the midst of chaos. Tune in as we highlight vulnerable stories of families who have addicted relatives and friends and learn how they have dealt with the challenges of isolation, desperation, and shame. If you are seeking ways to live your best life, then we welcome you into this safe space. Be a part of change today with your host, K.L. Wells.